Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A few notes before we start. First of all, we'd like to give a big, huge shout out to Real Clear Religion. For the past several weeks, they have been featuring our podcast on their weekly news aggregator site. Actually, it's a daily site, but we get featured once a week. So a big shout out to Real Clear Religion, your one-stop shop for all news, religious, and it comes with a great sense of humor. Also, I want to thank a number of our listeners who are starting to leave comments on our discussion board as well as write to me. Some of you have come with some very interesting topics, and I want to let you know that I'm tracing down some leads, and hopefully pretty soon we'll have a podcast on Hasidic Jews in New York. So please stay tuned for that. All right, let's get on with our regular show now. My guest today is Brian Grimm, president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, and a leading expert on the socioeconomic impact of restrictions on religious freedom and international religious demography. Brian is a member of the World Economic Forum's Council on the Role of Faith and advisor for the Religion and Geopolitics Project of the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. He is an associate scholar at the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown University and affiliated scholar at Boston University's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs. Prior to becoming the Foundation's president in 2014, Brian directed the largest social science effort to collect and analyze global data on religion at the Pew Research Center. He also worked for 2 decades as an educator in the former Soviet Union, China, Central Asia, the Middle East, and Europe, but not Antarctica. Brian holds a doctorate in sociology from the Pennsylvania State University and is author of numerous articles and books, including The Price of Freedom Denied, The World Religion Database, The World's Religion in Figures, and The Yearbook of International Religious Demography. The book Price of Freedom Denied was the topic of one of our previous podcasts about 2 years ago with Brian's co-author Roger Finke. We will link to that podcast as well as Brian's books and his foundation at our website, so please visit us and check those out. Brian, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good to be with you, Tony.
I was reading through your biography here, and I noted that you had been teaching in the Soviet Union, China, Central Asia, Middle East, and Europe. Plus, your foundation has got some things brewing in South America, and I know you visited Africa. And as I noted, the one place that you really haven't been promoting religious freedom has been Antarctica. What's up with that?
Well, I actually worked on Antarctica way back in my college days. One of my good friends in college was a Chinese social scientist doing, an environmental scientist doing work in Antarctica. So I figured I had that covered, so I went on to the rest of the world.
Yeah, well, there you go. Have you actually been to Antarctica then?
No, closest is Hobart, Tasmania.
Yeah, that is pretty close. Okay, well, those penguins are looking for some religious freedom, and I know you're going to get there because you are covering every place in the world, and that's what we want to do today is talk about religious liberty in the world, and our regular listeners to our podcast will probably recognize that religious liberty happens to be one of my favorite topics of discussion. Now, we've come at it from a number of different angles, including scholars who study the topic and lawyers involved in religious freedom cases, most of which that we focus on here on the program are in the U.S., but today is the first time that we dip into the area of religion and business, commercial business, those folks that make widgets and gadgets and all that kind of thing. That is somewhat unusual, and I'm curious about how your newly created organization, the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation, got its start. How did this thing come about?
Well, it's very interesting. The research I've been doing for the past decade has taken me all around the world to speak at places ranging from the UN to the European Parliament, U.S. Congress, and in all those places, at each place, people that show up tend to be either government workers or people from NGOs, the civil society, religious groups, advocacy organizations, and I've noticed through the years that business people seldom show up. And at the data, you know, there are some clear connections between religious freedom and other socioeconomic outcomes that business people would be interested in, not the least of which is stability and peace. So really it was the data itself that led me to start thinking about why businesses aren't there, and then to start talking to folks about that. And as I talked to people from prime ministers and presidents to lawyers and advocates, asking them, how come you think businesses aren't involved? And their answer was, well, you know, really nobody's ever connected the dots for them. So that's what the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation is really all about, is helping connect those dots, both from the data and practical situations, for businesses to see how religious freedom impacts what they do, and perhaps what they can do to make a difference, to make the world a better place as they make their widgets and gadgets.
One of the things that I noticed is that not only are you the president, but you're the founder. One thing I have never done in my life is create a foundation, and it seems to me like a pretty intimidating task. You were working at the Pew Foundation just a while ago, and how did you go through the process of setting up a foundation? You just pick up your briefcase one day and say, you know, I'm going to go to the Create a Foundation factory and create one, or how does this happen?
Well, this is actually the second foundation that I've set up. The first was back during the Soviet Union period, set up a foundation called the Central Asia Foundation, which then started a foundation in Central Asia called SINIM, which in Kazakh means trust. And that foundation is actually still going, and one of the projects that it got going was starting the first business institute in Soviet Central Asia during the really right after the fall of the Soviet Union. In fact, one of our projects was to take the Central Communist Party school where they trained all the cadres and turn it into a business institute. So I've had some experience setting up foundations and sort of seeing the potential in taking a non-profit approach to addressing issues as they relate to business.
So how do you pull this together? Is there some paperwork you have to fill out? Do you get a 501c3 status? Do you have to hire a board of directors, a staff? Who do you have all working for you, too?
Yeah, so to set up a foundation, there's a lot of paperwork that needs to be set up. You need to have set up a board of directors, have basically a constitution or the bylaws of the foundation. It needs to set out its objectives, and then on the one hand, that's just like setting up any company. Then the difference with a foundation or a charitable organization is that then you have to go through a rather lengthy process to apply to the IRS to be considered a tax-exempt organization, and that's perhaps the most complicated part. And, if you followed the news in the past several years, there was a backlog of cases for the IRS to make those considerations, and even some controversy on some of their decisions. That took the longest. And I think, if I remember, it was 25 pages of questions that had to be filled out.
Yeah.
And then attaching various documents. So to get one, a foundation or a charitable organization set up, requires some lawyers, and if you're fortunate, in this process, there are lawyers out there who are willing to help on a pro bono basis. So I had a whole team of lawyers willing to donate their time. And then the board of directors is really the owner, if you can use those terms, of a nonprofit. So the basic need for a foundation or an organization is three board members, and then a secretary treasurer can be one of those or can be a separate person. So we started off sort of with that level and then looking to grow it as needed. Then in terms of the number of people working with me, so I started this as a volunteer organization, and so I'm the leading volunteer, but we've got dozens of people all around the world who are joining in, and in fact we've even set up a sister organization in Brazil. We're looking to set up one in Italy and then sort of replicate the same model of an organization in numerous countries around the world.
I know, so you're locating in places that have really good food. Brazil, Italy, I don't know. It sounds suspicious. Do you have a regular staff that works with you, or is it just, you know, you're kind of doing this out of the back of your pickup truck or something?
It's out of the back of an airplane, I guess, is a better way to put it.
So that's true. You're all over the world.
All over the world. So at this point, there's some staff hired through the Brazil organization, but in the States, I'm the only full-time person. Then we have a half a dozen or so research fellows or research associates who are working at various degrees of status. So, and again, all on a volunteer basis. So the real trick in these kind of organizations is in startups is to have a clear idea of where the organization's going, what its mission is, and then develop those concepts over the course of time. And this may sound a little funny, but there's some benefit to not starting off with a big war chest and then starting to hire people to do things. Because in any new startup organization, people that do organizational research have shown that, whatever the ideas were that sort of started an initiative tend to not be the things that carry forth the initiative. So sort of in this first year, the aims of the organization are to say, here's what we're going to do some things, and we've been very successful in a number of things. But then, take stock and then start going after funding for those things that people are responding to rather than those things that at the start we thought they'd respond.
So where'd you get the funding for this?
One of the unique parts of this foundation came about because of my situation with working at the Pew Research Center. At Pew, the stipulation is that anybody working there has to take no position on the things we study and not advocate for any particular policy. So I had to essentially start the foundation without doing any fundraising or lining up any support for the endeavor. So in that way, it was you could call it a step of faith to step out and do it. And one of the advantages of starting without having a war chest at the beginning is something that is common with many new organizations, is that they start with a vision and then sort of work that vision and or uncompromising towards it. But by starting without having funders saying, here's what we're funding you to do, then it gives some flexibility to see what things people are responding to, what's working, and then to start going after funding after that, so that rather than promising funders will do something that we think will work, we can actually demonstrate what's working and then line up the funding.
Now, you mentioned that you had a number of successful things that you're working on right now, and we're going to discuss some of these in detail later, but just give us an idea of what some of the ventures that you're engaging in right now.
Yeah, well, one of the exciting ventures that we just completed and we're following up on was a series of case studies showing how businesses in their core activities can increase and support interfaith understanding, peace, or religious freedom, broadly defined. And we did that with a new organization that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, set up a year ago called Business for Peace. It's an organization within the UN Global Compact, which is the largest corporate social responsibility organization in the world with some 8,000 to 10,000 corporate members that subscribe to certain human rights and ethical principles. And Ban Ki-moon set this Business for Peace platform up, understanding that businesses have both an incentive and ability to do projects or do business in a way that can bring understanding between people and help lower conflict and therefore create better business environment. So we launched this joint study with the United Nations and our foundation at the UN Alliance for Civilizations Global Meeting in Bali, Indonesia, another place that has good food, by the way. And now we're promoting this series of case studies as examples other businesses can follow. And on Saturday, this week, I'll be going to Istanbul, Turkey, then to give a further report on this study and engage further more businesses on the topic at the first annual Business for Peace gathering.
Wow, and we're meeting this Friday in D.C., so you're racking up the frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, well, D.C. I can just drive to, but yeah, Istanbul, like I said, we're sort of running this show out the back of a Boeing.
There you go. Here's the question that I have. I'm interested in Brian Grimm and how he actually got into doing this. Now, you mentioned in the short term you were working at Pew, you created a foundation before, but I'm kind of more interested in the long-term stuff. I mean, most kids, when they're growing up, they want to be an astronaut or something like that. They rarely say, I want to found a foundation on business, peace, and religious liberty. How did you go from being a kid to the place you're at now?
Yeah, well, actually, I did have a dream of becoming an astronaut when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And had a nomination to the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Wow.
That in the end, I was on the waiting list, ready to be called up to, you know, get a commission. From the Air Force Academy, they basically were saying, you know, get ready to come. And then it didn't come. And it was one of those periods in life or situations in life when, you know, you think, wow, there must have been a reason for that. And because, you know, I was going to do civil engineering, and I had, you know, done all the, you know, college prep courses for engineering and trigonometry and all that stuff. And then I thought, you know, well, maybe this is a, you know, a sign from God that there's a, really that's, you know, learning how to fly planes and drop bombs isn't the thing for, that I should focus on. And then I went into sociology. How's that for a story?
Yeah.
The only other school I had applied to, because, you know, I was pretty sure I was going to the Air Force Academy, was University of Delaware, and then, you know, when I went, I had been accepted in engineering, and then, you know, just took all sociology and religious studies classes, and, you know, sort of got, you know, redirected to perhaps what I should, you know, as it turns out, what I should have been doing, you know, because I think, you know, God does have a hand in calling us and leading us, and I think that was, you know, at least one of those pivotal moments of life that you know, allow the choice to say, well, is engineering really the way for me to go?
But you're at the University of Delaware, home of the mighty Game Hens, if I'm correct.
No, the Fighting Blue Hens.
The Fighting Blue Hens. Okay.
Yeah.
The Fighting Blue Hens. The and you're in sociology around, I would guess, in the 1980s in college. And
yeah, well, it was in the late 70s.
Late 70s. Okay, so you're a few years older than me. That's not a time when a lot of people are studying the sociology of religion. How'd you tumble into that?
Well, you know, I studied sociology, then went, and there wasn't really a major in sociology of religion in college.
Right.
You know, just sociology, and then I just focused on religion and focused on Chinese studies. So I sort of had a minor in Chinese studies and major in sociology. But then when I graduated, I went to seminary, Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, you know, thinking, well, maybe, you know, I'd become a missionary or, you know, something along those lines. And got to seminary, and, you know, we were studying Greek and, you know, systematic theology, and it just was really an academic study of religion, and, you know, it wasn't too sociological, you know, it was very theological. The other thing I did at Delaware was I got a certificate in teaching English as a second language, a certificate program. So I dropped out of seminary and back in 1982 went to China as an English teacher. So, you know, so I made this shift from sociology as a preparation to go for theology, but then shifted again and actually went into English teaching. And then actually for a lot of years I was involved in language education and, you know, heading up projects on teacher education or managing projects in the Middle East and Central Asia. So really, I started off in sociology, shifted into, you know, education, practical education, and then in that process is when I set up the other foundation that I mentioned. And then it was not until later in life I came back to sociology, sort of my you know, earlier love, when my kids went back to college. So in 2002, I was directing the language and computer education at the Military Academy of the United Arab Emirates. And then my kids, you know, finished high school, two oldest ones finished high school, and we sent them back to Penn State and University of Oklahoma to start college. And then my wife and I realized, well, you know, we just can't send them back to the U.S. They grew up in mostly Muslim-majority countries, and it was tough for them to come back, so we just got on an airplane, and my wife actually did the legwork, went to Penn State and found two things. She talked to Roger Finke, who he and I ended up writing a book together, and then David Johnson at the Survey Research Center at Penn State. And so he had a way to bring me in and do the PhD, you know, help fund that. And then so through that, I got back into sociology, and Roger and I worked together on a project to start measuring religious freedom around the world. So, you know, all the experiences of being, you know, a person who, you know, is religious myself, and then, you know, working in these places where religious freedom is challenged, you know, former Soviet Union, China, Middle East. So I sort of came later in life to the program with a whole lot of ideas and experience of how the world worked. And then so I came back to study actually with Roger to see how I could use numbers to make sense of what I had been observing for 20 years overseas.
Was it kind of weird that you were going to graduate school at the same place your kid was going to college?
Well, at first we started off, he said, okay, this is my older son, and he drew a line across campus and said, okay, you know, this is my turf, your turf's up there. Yeah. And then as time went on, then that sort of that all broke down. So it was sort of weird. I mean, most of the people doing their in the graduate department were all the age of my kids, more or less. So, you know, I was sort of like I was the age of all the professors, you know, coming back in. And so that was a bit odd, and took a little bit of, you know, stepping back from what I was to, you know, sort of start over. But it really was a fabulous step to, you know, come back and sort of get skills and, you know how to do structural equation modeling when, you know, a lot of professors who were my age, you know, those were techniques that came about long after they had finished their graduate programs, you know, some decades before. So I came in and, you know, got some of the latest skills and coming to graduate school with a lifetime of, or at least, you know, a bunch of years of experience in the world, I think made it a very rewarding experience, at least for me.
Well, let's start to dig into some of the stuff that you found and some of the stuff that you're doing with your foundation. You're a sociologist, you're a data guy, you understand patterns that are happening out there, and you've worked with Pew for a while, and you're still going strong with really taking your methodological skills and applying them broadly to the world of religion and religious freedom. Tell us why the topic of religious freedom, which you founded your foundation on, should be of interest to anybody, let alone businesses.
Well, there's a number of reasons. So, to begin with, the other hat that I wear is a demographer. So I study religious populations, their growth and movement around the world. And both the studies I do at Pew and at Boston University find that the vast majority of people today are affiliated with some faith. I mean, they have varying levels of commitment to it, but more than 8 in 10 people today have a faith. And then even among the people, 10 to 15-16% of people who don't come out and say, I belong to this religion or one religion or another, many of them still have religious beliefs or engage in religious practices. So, for instance, in the United States, among the 20% of people who say they have no particular faith, 68% of them still believe in God. And in China, where half the population doesn't seem to express activity in a religion or belief in a religion, among the half of Chinese who don't have a religious faith, half of them still engage in prayer at their ancestors' tombs and you know, are in some way involved in what we would consider religious practice. So, you know, religion's an important topic for many people, so I think at the fundamental level, because so many people are involved in religion one way or another, knowing how free they are to make a choice to be part of a faith, change their faith, or have no faith are all very important to people in general.
Now, you've been all around the world globetrotting. What have you seen? You've also looked at the data here, too. What religions tend to be growing, and where are they growing the fastest?
Well, the religions that tend to grow the fastest are those that expect something out of their followers. So religions that just allow you to be a nominal member and don't expect much out of you tend not to be growing. So it's hard to say whether, you know, Christianity, Islam, or Hinduism or Buddhism, or, you know, which particular mega religion or world religion is growing, but within them, then you see pockets of growth. So, you know, within Christianity, Pentecostals, evangelicals, and then the sort of lively side of Catholicism, you know, the charismatic, and even the, you know, certain orders within Catholicism that, like Opus Dei and other groups, that tends to be the sources of growth within Christianity. And then I'd say that within Christianity, that's where we're seeing the growth. Within other faiths, it's a different story. So, for instance, in Islam, the main driver of growth in their population, at least, has been demography. So for decades, Muslims have had, on average, more children than non-Muslims. So there's a lot of demographic growth, but that trend is slowing. So surprising to some that in Iran, for instance, they're having fewer children per woman than we are here in the United States. In Tunisia, where the Arab Spring revolutions or so-called Arab Spring revolutions started, they dipped below replacement level fertility. So there's some changes within the Muslim world. They're now going through their demographic transition. And one of the topics of study I've done with some researchers in Vienna and Spain was to look at how these demographic changes might relate to religious violence, in addition to how government restrictions on religion relate to religious violence. And study found that, and this is also a finding that I had with Roger Finke in the book The Price of Freedom Denied and some other papers we did, was that as governments try to control and regulate religion, you could say too much, or to the extent that it's not just keeping religions from being sort of dominant, but really minutely controlling religion, that tends to create further animosities and hostilities and relate to religious violence. The other demographic side that we found was that when countries have gone through their demographic transition, that's going from very high fertility, having 4, 5, 6, 7 kids per woman, dropping down to 2 or 3, that transition itself can be associated with violence, because what you have is you then start having a youthful population that's smaller and then healthier because you're attending to healthcare needs, with higher expectations, and then that could be a trigger for violence, as it was in Tunisia and some of the Arab Spring countries. So that's one area I focus on, Middle East, Muslim-majority countries. And so they've got those two things that can be related to religious violence going on. One is, you know, very restrictive government policies and sort of this demographic transition where expectations are rising faster than society can meet them.
Now, you just mentioned that the Middle East is one of the places where there's problems here with religious liberty, and it's interesting to be talking about the demographic connection as well. I think that's a very fruitful area to be looking at. But where else are there problems with religious liberty in the world, and what are some of the major issues?
Well, I mean, every region of the world has some issue with religious freedom. So, you know, any freedom is very difficult to maintain. And so because whenever there's a security challenge or something new comes up, the natural tendency is to protect ourselves against it. So it's not unusual that religious freedom is always one of these human rights, or at least it's a recognized human right, that's always in tension with other concerns in society. So the big challenges today fall along two lines. One is when religious groups themselves are in conflict with one another, and that includes conflict within a religion. So, you know, Sunnis versus Shias, or if you have, Catholics versus Protestants, or different sects within Sikhism. So this religious conflict within a religion or between religions, so what we is generally called sectarian or communal violence, is one worrying trend. And then the other is when governments play favorites and sort of use religion for their own ends. So, high favoritism of one faith, not because the government necessarily wants to promote that religion for altruistic ends, but because the government can see that teaming up with that faith or supporting that faith can advance their own ends. So those are two trends. So like in the Middle East and North Africa, half of the countries in the region have sectarian violence. And so you're having one religious group fighting another. And then almost all of the countries, 19 out of the 20 countries, have very high levels of government favoritism. So those two work in tandem to create maybe a religious freedom perfect storm, as you know some might call it. So where you've got both of these indicators of challenges to religious freedom related to a cycle of ongoing violence. So in a country like China, where there are very, extremely high restrictions coming from the government, the sectarian tensions have been relatively low. So in society, it tends to be open and people haven't gravitated towards religion as a source of identity that leads to conflict. That is until recently. And so the two big regions within China that are facing problems are Tibet, and then straight north of Tibet, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. So in those two areas, religion has become sort of a focal point, rallying point for the populations that are dissatisfied with Chinese policy and in those regions. So even within a country like China, where you don't see widespread sectarian violence like erupted in Egypt during their Arab Spring revolution, but in China, it's very worrying because the whole western part of the country is facing these religious tensions, and government policy tends to be to add more restrictions on the religious populations, Muslims in terms of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang and Buddhists in Tibet. And so rather, at least as I'm observing, rather than these additional restrictions, such as not letting kids be trained in religion and and, you know, imposing other kinds of restrictions, that tends to aggravate the situation rather than calm it down.
One of the things that you noted in some of your writings, and we'll link to a number of your writings, was that Brazil actually happens to be more religiously free than the United States. And now I know you're setting up a major footprint down there in Brazil. That's a pretty bold claim. A lot of people would say Brazil freer religiously than the United States. What's going on here?
Well, that's an interesting case, and it's one, it's just the data. I looked at the data, and it was one of those aha moments for me, because as a person studying religious freedom and having worked in the Middle East and North and Asia and communist and Muslim areas, you know, I was always focused on where the problems were. And then, you know, one day I just said, well, let's look at the 25 most populous countries and the level of government restrictions on religion, which isn't a direct measure of religious freedom, but it's, you know, it's sort of measuring the inverse. It's measuring the absence of controls. And lo and behold, Brazil came out on top. I mean, these numbers fluctuate a little bit year to year. But, you know, I looked at that and thought, well, you know, if we're, now I'm working on an organization trying to promote religious freedom. I said, well, if I'm trying to initiate a global movement to come up with new ideas of how we can reverse these rising tides of religious hostilities and restrictions, well, why not go to places where the situation's relatively calm and start, you know, seeing if those folks would be interested to get involved. So went to Brazil and, you know, sort of armed with my data chart flipped upside down, where I'm looking at the least restrictive countries instead of the problem countries. And I had a meeting with the vice president of Brazil, Michel Temer, who's a constitutional lawyer, helped write their provisions on religious freedom, and, you know, told him about some things. He was interested to hear what I'm doing in Brazil. And I said, well, you know, here's why I'm interested in Brazil, is because of Brazil's place in the world. And I showed him the chart and left off Brazil from the chart. And then he looked at it and said, but, you know, where's Brazil? And I said, well, it's actually got the lowest government restrictions. And he, you know, sat back in his chair, and he's normally a poker-faced guy. And, you know, he sort of started smiling, and he said, well, you know, I'm a constitutional lawyer, and I wrote our provisions on this, and I'm the vice president. I didn't know this. And he looked around the room and said, anybody else know this? And, you know, nobody else had. So it's, you know, it's sort of a positive approach to religious freedom. It's, you know, I'm not advocating the Brazil model as necessarily a model for the world, but, you know, there are some interesting things in Brazil. And I think the thing that, two things really struck me in my work in Brazil. First is that people there really care about religious freedom. And I spoke at a religious freedom festival, and they had 30,000 people out on the streets, and the stage had laser lights and rock bands, and you know, you know, imagine getting, you know, 30,000 people off for a religious freedom festival to celebrate religious freedom, you know, in some town in the U.S. So, you know, there's some popular feeling, but the other is to just think for a moment how it is that Brazil, a country, Tony, that you've studied and you know something about too, has gone through such a religious change, going from nearly everybody being Catholic some decades ago to today, nearly a third of the people leaving the Catholic Church and becoming Pentecostal, Evangelical, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, Seventh-day Adventist, and a whole host of other things, and there's been no violence. So, you know, think of Russia and Ukraine right now. You know, those divisions fall along religious lines, including, you know, the large Catholic populations in Ukraine and Russia being Orthodox. What if a third of Russians would become Catholic? You know, they're going from Orthodox to Catholic. You know, could that happen without violence? You know, the long wars in Europe over religion. What if a third of Egyptians would become Christian? What if a third of Iranians, which are all Shia, would become Sunni? Or what if a third of you know, people in Egypt would, of Muslims in Egypt, would shift from Sunni to Shia? You know, would these changes happen without violence as they did in Brazil. So rather than, you know, having any answers to, you know, what makes Brazil special, you know, I just have noted that, you know, that it's an untold story, and maybe there's some lessons from Brazil that we need to learn and study. And as I've shared, you know, I spoke at various universities in Brazil and you know, government folks and business people. And, you know, the first question is, wow, that's really interesting. I wonder why. And so that's part of what our foundation is doing, is setting up some research projects and even some projects at the undergraduate level to help people start looking at this intersection of, you know, faith and freedom and you know, what it is about Brazil and you know, if they've been able to maintain that peaceful religious change, you know, what are the secrets and what needs to be done to keep it that way and not let it devolve into a conflictual situation.
I want to turn to the business angle of your foundation now, but before we do that, I have to comment on Brazil because it is such an interesting case, and you mentioned, you know, roughly a third to 40% of Catholics left to become Pentecostals, Seventh-day Adventists at all. What's really interesting about that, from my own studies too, is that it's not that the Catholic Church necessarily lost out in this process, but the Catholic Church became stronger in the process. That you'll see a number of bishops admit this. They say, well, you know, 100 years ago, we weren't doing too good missionizing everybody. Now these Protestants come along and really challenge us. And the Catholics are stronger for the religious liberty that they're experiencing as well.
Yeah, I've met with two of the leading cardinals in Brazil, Cardinal Arani in Rio, the newly appointed cardinal, and Cardinal Scherer in Sao Paulo, and both echo what you've just said.
Yeah, and I wrote that some 20 years ago, and people kind of laughed at me, so I'm glad that you got some evidence for that. So
yeah.
Let's go ahead and dig into this business thing. The issue of religious freedom really seems to be something that would matter for politicians, your vice president in Brazil, or for diplomats to worry about. And I know the U.S. has its own International Religious Freedom Commission. We talked to Robbie George about that, and we even assigned an ambassador to deal with this issue. But you're taking a completely different and unique approach by making this an issue of commercial business people, the folks who make those widgets and gadgets. Here's two questions. And let's address them one at a time, but here I'm going to lay them out to begin with. First of all, why should business care about religious liberty? And then second of all, why or how can businesses actually make a difference in this area? So let's go ahead and start with that first one. Why should businesses care about religious freedom?
Well, I'll give an example that sort of addresses both questions. I just came back from Indonesia, and the host of my meeting there was the head of the UN Global Compact for Indonesia, a guy named YK Junardi. So, Mr. Junardi is you wouldn't guess it by the name, but he's a Chinese, ethnic Chinese background businessman in Indonesia. So, you know, something about Indonesia. A number of years ago, all the Chinese were forced to take on Indonesian names. So, you know, maybe their name was Han, and now their name is, you know, Junardi. Had to take traditional names. And so there, in the early 90s, there was a tremendous ethnic and religious conflict in Indonesia. You know, East Timor split off, being majority Christian. There were riots and against ethnic Chinese, so sort of these conflicts in Indonesia lined up along religious and ethnic grounds, and, you know, the minorities suffered the most. So many of the Chinese who tended to be either Christian or Buddhist, you know, their businesses were attacked and ransacked, their, you know, places of worship were burned. And so from that experience, business people in Indonesia realize that there's many things that they could do and they do that could help lower these tensions and build trust between religious communities. So sort of their on the ground was, you know, that was a horrible experience for a country to devolve into ethnic and religious hatred and conflict. So, you know, how can we prevent that? Because that's bad for not only, you know, people's lives, but it destroyed many, many businesses and, you know, set Indonesia backwards, both as economically and you know, as a nation. So what they've done is business people have realized, well, to make sure that doesn't happen again, let's think through how our businesses can be places where religion is not something that is a dividing line between our workers and communities, but it's something that brings people together. So they've been doing a number of projects, both in their core business as well as in their social outreach, that tried to lower to increase religious interfaith understanding and therefore, you know, religious freedom. These range from, you know, in their places of business, if you're a Christian business owner, making sure you have a Muslim prayer room and a Christian prayer room, and if you're a Muslim business owner, the same. So they, you know, thinking through, well, what are the religious needs of our people? And again, people tend to be, you know, take their faith into their business more actively than in many Western countries. So accommodating religious needs in the workplace has been a aim of many business people. So when it comes time for Eid, the different Muslim celebrations, they'll figure out ways to help their employees travel safely back to their families, which is always a big one of the challenges in Indonesia. And then businesses, once they start being sensitive to religious freedom and religious tension issues, they start realizing the needs that the lack of religious freedom brings. So one of the problems in Indonesia is that interfaith couples have a hard time getting married because there's no mechanisms for a Muslim to marry a Christian, for instance, or a Hindu to marry a Buddhist, because the marriages need to be along religious lines. But there, you know, there's some legal ways around it that the government was slow in implementing. But businesses said, well, you know, these folks can't get their kids registered in schools because they're not a legitimately married couple. Therefore, their kids don't get the school vouchers and they don't get health care. So let's solve this. Let's solve the legal problem. Let's have a big mass wedding, get 5,000 couples married at a time, and then they can get on with life and be contributing members of society. So, and then they've done that, and they're starting, I think, trying to have an annual interfaith marriage where they, you know, make this happen for couples that are sort of in legal limbo. That's just one example from one country.
This is really interesting what is happening in Indonesia, because it almost seems to be the exact opposite here in the United States, in that in Indonesia, you have businesses really getting involved in the issue of religious liberty and religion, bringing together interfaith couples and having marriages and such. Here in the United States, the reaction typically tends to be, whoa, let's step away from that controversial issue. So you see a secularizing tendency on the case of businesses. They, you know, if you went to them, they'd say, I don't even want to worry about religious liberty. I sell widgets. I sell gadgets. Let's just keep all religion out of the factory, no prayer rooms, nothing. Why is it going in the opposite direction in Indonesia? Why doesn't a business in Indonesia say, I wash my hands of this issue, I don't want to paint a target on my back getting into these sectarian divisions, we're just a secular business?
That's a good question. I've never thought of comparing the difference between the United States and Indonesia. But I think one of the big differences is that in Indonesia, by law, everyone is required to have a religion. So it's not a matter of choice. So if you say that I have no religion, you're breaking the law. So in Indonesia, faith is sort of expected. In the United States, there's no such requirement. So perhaps Indonesia is a little bit more overtly religious in that the country itself is set up with a philosophy that's at its root anti-atheist, anti-communist. So, you know, quite part of the norm in Indonesia. In the United States, we have the situation of separation of church and state, which then is sort of an actively discussed and disputed understanding. So we have, you know, free protection for the free practice of religion in the First Amendment, but also that the government should have no law that establishes the religion. So, you know, this has been a very active debate in the United States. And so sort of that non-establishment clause gets carried over into many other public sectors of life. So as the United States has become, I guess you could say, more centralized, you know, there are more laws coming from the center than from the states on a number of topics, then that non-establishment clause then, you know, applies in many areas of life, and people just take, this is just my guess, but, and you may have ideas on this too, I know you do, Tony, that, you know, that separation of religion is from everything, you know, in any area of public life, whether it's in business or, you know, in a meeting of a school board, you know, there's people are saying, well, we shouldn't have prayer at the school board meeting, or we shouldn't have prayer in a company or any other place where people gather for non-religious purposes. You know, religion oughtn't be there because maybe my religion is different than your religion, and that'll offend someone. So it's that, you know, I think these are some of the trends that are going on in the United States in this very complex situation. And, you know, some of it, I think even people of faith, you know, are sensitive to not, you know, being that they want to be fair and not create a situation where it seems like we're trying to push, one person's pushing their religion on another. So I think because of that, it becomes, you know, a difficult topic in companies. But on the other side, you know, the United States is a very religious country. You know, it has lots of people, high levels of religious activity, of belief. And belief is part of what motivates and inspires people even to make gadgets. You know, I'll give just one quick example. Kellogg's Corn Flakes came out of a religious conviction. So even the creation of a world-changing product in the United States, Kellogg's Corn Flakes, came about because two Seventh-day Adventist brothers saw everybody eating, you know, ham and greasy eggs for breakfast, and they said, that's not good for the temple of the Holy Spirit. So they started working on cornflakes as a substitute. The company was called Sanitaris, I think. And it originally was an Adventist company. Now it's, you know, it's a secular company. But it was that religious motivation that moved them to think of a new product and innovate. So I think that, you know, to allow some, you know, to recognize that religion can be a source of inspiration within companies and even create new product ideas. So is makes religion perhaps an asset to businesses that if you, you know, say we're a religion-free zone, not a religious freedom zone, but free from religion, we may be missing some of the sources of inspiration that could help a company and an economy be more competitive and creative in the years to come.
I think that's a very interesting observation, one worthy of further investigation here, because, you know, in the places in the United States where you have overtly religious business leaders such as Hobby Lobby or Chick-fil-A, they tend to get pilloried, at least recently. And the laws that we are seeing put into place are increasingly encroaching upon their ability to run their business the way they want to. And as you remark, in Indonesia, it's very different. And in Brazil, it's probably very different as well. Let me move the conversation in a slightly different direction here and look at the nuts and bolts of how you, in your foundation, actually go and motivate a business leader to care about the topic, because that's got to be pretty tough. And again, my view is thinking through the United States, you go to a business and say, hey, you should be concerned more about religious liberty. You go to Acme widget company and they're going to look at you and say, whoa, look at what happened to Hobby Lobby or Chick-fil-A. They, you know, they're bad guys in the media, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want any of that. But your whole basis of your foundation is to go to some of these business leaders and say, listen, this is a serious issue. You need to wrestle with it. So how do you do that?
Well, I think, if we think in the United States context, that religious freedom has become a political issue, partly in the response to the Hobby Lobby case, but, this ongoing tension of separation of religion from other things, religion and state, religion and public life, religion and business. So one of the initiatives that I'm working on that I think has appeal for business people is to look at religious freedom as just a basic matter of equality, fairness, and human rights. So rather than think of religious freedom as a political topic, just think of it as a fairness issue, just like, we're concerned that we don't have gender discrimination within the workplace, that we don't have, other kinds of racial discrimination in the workplace. Religious freedoms, we should be just as concerned that we're not doing things that impinge upon people's free expression of religion, in sensitive ways, or, not allowing people to push it down other people's throats. But at the same time, we don't want them to leave perhaps one of the most important sources of identity and inspiration at the door when they come into the business. So we want to make a business a place where people can feel free about what they are and who they are. So I think businesses in the U.S. are increasingly concerned about being fair and not in any way setting up a workplace that's unfriendly to people's, core identities and convictions. So as I talk to, one of my concerns is that, however this is approached within businesses in the U.S., that it be approached in a way that people from the left and the right both say, well, that makes sense. And, that's a reasonable understanding. So one of our initiatives is to, promote, you might not like this, you'll have to tell me, a European term, which is freedom of religion or belief, and the acronym for freedom of religion or belief, FORB. So we're promoting the idea of FORB-friendly business, that the business is committed to the, respecting the human right of freedom of religion or belief, to have a belief, change of belief, or have no belief at all, for their employees within society and within the larger world, and just make that a matter of principle. So it's very easy for companies in their corporate documents to say, we're just like we don't discriminate based on religion. We also are, FORB friendly. We respect the religious beliefs of people in the company. And I'll give one example of this that was instrumental in reducing religious tensions in the U.S. right after 9/11, Ford Motor Company in Detroit had been having interfaith dialogue sessions in their plants in Detroit, where Muslims were teaching other folks in the factories what it was to be a Muslim. And then 9/11 happened, and there was the potential for violent backlash against Muslims. But Ford was able to then take this dialogue that was already going on and start activating those networks and say, well, let's help people understand that what happened on 9/11 wasn't Muslims in Detroit, and here's what they believe. So, some of this is useful, realizing we are in a religiously charged world. It's, I think, also prudent that companies, have some policies related to freedom of religion or belief.
Yeah, I don't know why you said I wouldn't like that. I have to admit, I am Forbes friendly.
Yeah.
And I also like Ford. So yeah. I am Forb and Ford friendly.
Yeah, well, I didn't know if you'd like me bringing in some European idea to the American situation.
Oh, there, yes, the European ideas. No, they have some good ideas. They had Adam Smith, and that was all good. Those are kind of interesting ideas. How have business leaders been reacting to this? Are there certain types of business leaders or certain industries that are more open to this than others? I mean, you're going to go out and sell this, and you know, I can just imagine the typical CEO or you know, vice president of a company. You approach them and they say, "Hey, I want to talk to you about Forb-friendly business and religious freedom." And they look at you and they say, "Hey, listen, I got my stockholders in the other room. I got a lot of other things going on." How do you pitch this to them, and who's really receptive to this idea?
Well, there's different business people are receptive for different reasons. So, people that tend to be more religious, whatever their religion, and they're the head of a company, then they're sort of naturally interested in this topic. So then for them, the question isn't whether this is valuable and important, but then it really becomes sort of the heart of your question. Well, you know, how would I sell this to others who might not care anything about religion or religious issues. So that's one. And then to answer those questions, it can be a positive and a sort of a negative answer. So in what I do, I try to focus on the positive, but there is a negative side. So I think, Tony, you probably know the case with Abercrombie & Fitch, where they fired a young Muslim stock girl in one of their stores in the U.S. Because she was wearing a scarf while she was putting the clothes up on the shelf, and they fired her just because she wore a scarf, which she described as being an essential part of her own faith to cover her head. And they said, well, that's breaking our dress code. And then for months, Abercrombie & Fitch was in the news for a religious discrimination case. And so they had to not only fight the case and expend money on that, but then they also had the negative publicity. And in the end, they lost the case, had to make a settlement, and then people like me go around and talk about it. So then, since then, they've changed their policy. But that's a cost side.
Mm-hmm.
A company really doesn't need, no company wants to have that. So another example along those lines is for Cadbury in Malaysia. It was called the chocolate jihad. They were facing a chocolate jihad because in their products, somebody did an analysis and found that they had some pork fat in the chocolate. So, of course, that's, haram. It's not allowed. And then the company itself went through all of these costs trying to prove that they, understand that Muslims can't have any pork products and that indeed their chocolate doesn't have it. But part of that was because the company, right from the start, wasn't attuned to the religious issues involved with the business. So I think that's a negative. But on the positive side, when you start paying attention to religion in a business, then you're going to avoid some problems that can come up in markets. And again, one little tidbit from my past: I put myself through college in part by working at the third largest caramel factory in the U.S. And so we made the toffee, and if you've ever had butter rum toffee,
oh yeah.
Very good. Well, this was back in the late 70s, and, we were exporting our toffee to the Middle East, and we were sending it to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and other places. And, I remember very clearly, we were very careful to take all the butter rum toffee out of the mixed toffees that we were shipping to the Middle East. So, for businesses, just having a focus on religious freedom or freedom of religion or belief also allows them to be sensitized to religious issues that may come up in their business. So I think, for business people operating in today's world where religion is a hot topic, they all can recognize that that religion has the potential to be a benefit or to be a detriment to them if they don't understand it among their employees or in their marketing or in their the distribution and sale of their products.
Yeah, I think the Abercrombie and Fitch example is a good one. Also, Cadbury and your toffee factory is another one in that, you know, you just got to be aware of these things and sensitive to them. I mean, which leads me to a very important question. You took out all these butter rum toffees before you shipped them out. You don't happen to have any laying around anymore, do you?
Well, they'd be a little bit hard now. But
all right. I was thinking to score some butter rum toffee here, but I guess that's not gonna happen. Anyways, I want to finish off here in our last few minutes that we have and ask you a little bit of a question about the future. Your foundation is pretty new, and you're making some great strides. You're raising some big, huge issues here, and people are, especially outside of the United States, are really starting to perk up and take notice, which is a really delightful thing to hear. What does the future look like in two respects? Where do you see your foundation going and having an impact? And second of all, looking at the grand scheme of history here and maybe just looking 10 years out, do you think things are going to start improving in terms of religious liberty, or are you pessimistic on that front?
Well, I'm doing this foundation as sort of the outgrowth, not just of my research and sort of history and abilities, but, you know, I think this is something that's on the heart of God. So, you know, for me, you know, I have some faith that the future of the world is something of concern to God, and so I'm hopeful that as I try my best to be faithful to what I see God calling me to do, that'll allow me to make contributions where I can. So that's sort of a personal belief, but I hold it strongly, and it doesn't mean everything I do will be successful. And sometimes, you know, doing the right thing, leads to, criticism. But I'm very optimistic that, this is a message that's important and on God's heart to help people get along and help really the most powerful people in the world, business people, help support that message. And in terms of the future, I think that perhaps business is really one of the most hopeful areas to engage on this issue, because they're really at the crossroads of culture, creativity, and commerce, and they have innovative ideas, and they have the ability and resources to act, just like in Indonesia, where government can't solve a problem, they can just jump in and help people get married. And I think that in a whole variety of ways, just when challenged to, think of double bottom lines, not just making money, which is essential for business, but also, what can they do that can make the world a better place at the same time? So that, not all business people are in it just for the money. In fact, you can see that business people who've been very successful often finish their career and, think of what they can do philanthropically. And so, I think that desire is there, among many business people, to see their endeavors not just make money, but do good for the world. So I'm hopeful that sort of this wave of good business being good for the economy and good for peace and interfaith understanding will continue.
Well, it's always good to end on an optimistic note. I share your optimism in this, and I appreciate the actions that you're doing with your organization, the Freedom and Business Foundation, which my listeners can find at religiousfreedomandbusiness.org. That's all one word, and we will link to it on our website. And my guest today has been the president of that organization, Brian Grimm. Brian, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It was a fun conversation today.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts,
please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.